Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's May 1st, 2014 7th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 12-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 4, Current M&A Issues in Transactions Involving the Advisors Act. Alec Dawson, Cheryl Orr, and Richard Morris will discuss current M&A issues and transactions involving the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. Now, on to the podcast.
Good morning. The first topic we are discussing today is purchase price adjustments. For buyers in many asset management-related transactions, purchase price adjustments are an important component of any transaction because they enable buyers to pay only for the business that they're actually acquiring. There are various types of direct and indirect purchase price adjustments. Financial indicator adjustments are a type of direct purchase price adjustment. Some examples of these include a requirement that the target business have a certain level of assets under management at the time of closing. You can also do it as a requirement that there's less than a specified percentage of fund investors that have made redemption requests at the time of closing, or a requirement that a specific number of clients or clients representing a specified amount of AUM have consented to the transaction prior to the closing. Deferred compensation for management is an indirect type of purchase price adjustment. If deferred compensation is not addressed, it essentially increases the purchase price for the buyer because the buyer will be paying for the deferred compensation after closing for value created during the seller's ownership of the target business. There are various ways to address deferred compensation. You could adjust the purchase price to account for it. You could require the seller to pay for it before closing. When you're determining how to address purchase price adjustments, various considerations come into play. Is the deferred compensation contingent on certain considerations? And if so, presumably the seller will only want to pay for the deferred comp upon these conditions being met. So you have to structure it so either they are reimbursed if they're not met, or they only pay at the time that they're met. Alec, you want to talk about redemptions?
A lot of the game here is trying to ensure certainty of transaction, which both sellers and buyers want in an area that's in some ways uniquely uncertain with respect to the actual assets you're going to acquire. Gates, redemptions, all the types of things that could happen in the ordinary course of business could affect significantly the value of the business that's being acquired. One way to try and limit those risks is to diligence the specific contracts at issue and the compensation arrangements at issue as much as you can up front so you can build in specific and fair risk allocation metrics to properly adjust the purchase price. One of the key things to keep in mind, and that's always negotiated, is how long will you face these purchase price adjustments? At some juncture, the buyer just has to take the risk of the business that they're buying, that for whatever reason, people may leave the platform. It's often done maybe to the end of a calendar year, maybe 12 months out. It could depend on the specifics of a certain client relationship or contractual relationship that could be specifically adjusted, maybe with respect to the lengths of certain contracts. Various mechanics we can come up with to deal with this. They could include collars on the purchase price, ups and down, baskets, again, specific adjustments with respect to a specific contract that was at risk. Maybe one particular client is a huge issue and people will be willing to take a bigger hit on that. You can do an escrow. You can also do an earn out in combination with any of these. Rich?
So the next area we wanted to talk about is an example of a type of issue that you should, of course, be thinking about when you're considering any form of merger or other transaction. In addition to thinking about the impact on the company that you may be acquiring, it's important to think about the impact on that company's clients and what regulatory and other responsibilities that might trigger. So we thought we'd spend some time talking about assignment and change of control. So in considering any transaction, you need to think about whether the transaction may be deemed an assignment or change of control, because that will trigger either negative consent requirements or actual consent requirements from the advisor's clients. So let's start with the Investment Advisors Act. There's requirements under the Advisors Act, the Company Act, and ERISA regulations relating to assignment and change of control. So starting with the Advisors Act, and I have several slides, but I'm just going to touch on them. You can read them at your convenience. Section 205A2 of the Advisors Act makes it unlawful for an SEC-registered advisor to enter into or perform an advisory contract unless the advisory contract provides that no assignment of the contract shall be made by the advisor without client consent. Well, what is an assignment? An assignment is broadly defined to be any direct or indirect transfer of a controlling block of shares. What do we mean by controlling block? Typically, control means when you have the power to exercise a controlling influence over the management or policies of the advisor. Control is usually presumed when there's an ownership of 25% or more of an advisor's outstanding voting securities. So if you're doing a transaction that results in an acquisition of 25% or more of the advisor's voting securities, it is in all likelihood going to be deemed to be a change of control. One exception to that, though, is the SEC does recognize certain types of reorganization transactions where control of the ultimate parent may not change. In those cases, you can look to Rule 202A to see whether there's an actual change of control. In thinking about control, if it is deemed to be an assignment or a change of control, then you need to get some form of consent. In many cases, we recommend getting affirmative consent if it's easy to obtain that consent, but regulations in the SEC position under the Advisors Act simply require a negative consent. So we recommend that you inform the advisor's clients in writing sufficiently in advance of the transaction so that you can be deemed to have gotten the appropriate negative consent. There are other requirements under the Company Act and ERISA that require affirmative consent, but we can leave that for another day. Alec?
So now that you've gone through your consent process and your purchase price adjustments, what are these deals often about? And I think we all recognize that they're often about buying management. You're going to buy these management companies, and if you don't get the senior guys, you're not really going to get what you're paying for. So as Rich will discuss in a minute, some care needs to be taken to make sure you'll be able to market their track record under the new platform that you establish. But you have to take a lot of time and negotiate a lot of specifics to make sure that the management you want is going to be comfortable staying with the platform, because they're going to be essential to keep the assets sticky. Economically, you're going to be able to do that with some type of incentive compensation, often structured as a profits interest or something else, so that they get advantage tax treatment. Then you'll have various transfer restrictions with respect to their ability to transfer their economic interest, either directly or indirectly, if they invest through a management holdco. That's a trick sometimes people miss. You have to give yourself, as the buyer, third-party beneficiary rights to enforce those transfer restrictions so they can't economically get liquidity indirectly above that they couldn't get down below. And then you have to think about the cultural fit. And a lot of times we see these transactions take place because a management team is unhappy with their current owner or their current platform for whatever reason, either because they don't like the culture, they don't feel that the current owner is investing enough time and money into it, they want to do one thing with respect to the business and other people want to do another thing. So you often negotiate complicated sort of joint venture arrangements up front, giving management certain day-to-day controls, maybe certain commitments, maybe non-competes. You know, maybe the owner is a private equity buyer and they're also competing in the space, and the management wants to make sure that there's going to be a commitment to this platform and not some other platform. So a lot of time needs to be taken to address all those issues as you would do in any type of joint venture.
So as Alec indicated, one of the key drivers of many acquisitions is not only the ability to obtain assets, but the ability to use the performance of the entity that you're acquiring. The guidance from the SEC in this area under the Investment Advisors Act comes from a series of no-action letters. I'm not going to discuss them. We've referenced them in the slides. We're happy to answer any questions about them, but you can look through the slides for the specifics. But in general, what it boils down to is a few basic principles come from these letters, that if you are an advisor and you're acquiring a firm, there are certain requirements that need to be met for a successor entity to use the performance and track record of a predecessor entity. Key requirement is that the persons who are managing the account of the new entity must also have been primarily responsible for the performance at the old entity. So you need to think about it in an acquisition. Are you bringing over the key management team? Are you bringing over the key portfolio managers? If you don't bring them all over or don't bring them over in the right combination, you may lose the ability to use that performance track record. Another key must be that the accounts at the new entity must be managed in a way that is so similar to the accounts at the old entity that the performance comparison is relevant. And also, you need to be careful about cherry picking. The new entity can't simply cherry pick the best performers from the old entity. If you're going to use predecessor performance, you need to use all of that performance, unless the exclusion of certain accounts would not cause that performance to be materially higher. And then, of course, any advertising and marketing information that you're doing must also be consistent with prior SEC guidance and prior SEC disclosure requirements. Another thing to think about is that you can't use that performance track record unless you have the rights to use the records that back that performance track record. And that often becomes a negotiating point in the documents relating to the transaction.
So on that, we could talk a little bit about transition services agreements and non-compete arrangements, not with management, but between the buyer and seller if they're going to stay in the same business, which sometimes happens. And here the transition services agreements take on new or different importance than they often do in another type of context. As Rich mentioned, you really need to ensure in this area that's so highly regulated that you have access to all the records you need to operate. Now, the seller still needs to maintain access to those records because whatever happened under their ownership still remains their problem from a regulatory perspective. So that can mean very lengthy transition services arrangements, very lengthy access to information covenants. Particular care needs to be taken to commingled electronic records. That seems to come up in every deal. It's not as if everything in this particular asset management division of a huge company is siloed on this one server, and you can just drive it across the street, and everything is ready to go. So those are things we often spend a lot of time on that get overlooked in different types of M&A transactions. So now we're going to shift over to liability concerns. And Rich has one particular example.
Sure. I get to do a lot of talking in this section, but I'll try to keep it brief. You know, one of the areas that's obviously important in any transaction is liability, indemnification, due diligence in advance of the transaction. We thought we would pick one example under the Advisors Act to focus on. There's obviously other examples that we could have picked. But this is something that seems very small, but can actually have a quite draconian impact. And that is the pay-to-play prohibitions under Rule 2064-5 of the Investment Advisors Act. This is important to think about if you're involved in an acquisition where a company that you're acquiring does significant business with government entities. So what does this rule say? This rule says, at a high level, that an investment advisor may not be compensated by a government entity for advisory services within 2 years after it or its covered associate contributes to an official of the government entity. So the first question is, what types of entities are we talking about? The rule applies to advisors who manage or solicit government assets through a covered investment pool. Well, what is a covered investment pool? It's a hedge fund, it's a mutual fund, it could be a collective investment trust, it could be a venture capital fund. It's a quite broad list, actually. Who is a covered associate? We have a specific definition in the slides we gave you, but in general, a covered associate is a senior executive, it's a managing member, it's a general partner, it's someone on the sales team. It can also be someone who doesn't fulfill one of those positions, but who is promoted or moved into one of those positions. So the compliance burden here can be quite high. What does this rule prohibit? It prohibits contributions made to government officials. There's a de minimis exception, but it's quite low. So a couple of $100 contribution to the head of a pension plan or a governor or someone who has control over the way a government entity invests its assets could cause the entire firm to lose the ability to receive compensation from that client for 2 years. This is obviously a quite draconian result, and it's important that you address these things in your purchase documents in the form of appropriate liability and indemnification provisions. I'll mention one more thing before we turn it over to a more detailed discussion. The SEC has recognized that this is a quite draconian impact, and within the last 6 to 12 months has started to grant exemptive relief in this area, but only under very limited circumstances. So with that said, it's important to make sure you address this in your appropriate documents prior to the acquisition, and I'll turn it back over to Alec and Cheryl to talk more about that.
So as Rich said, you need to protect yourself in the purchase agreement against those specific risks. But what do you do if you face this hypothetical? You've bought the target. You've got all, you diligence everything you could. You've got specific indemnities and purchase price adjustments. And 3 weeks after closing, you get a call who says, you know, this thing you just bought, part of their business was acting as a custodian for some assets that Bernie Madoff was involved in. It's going to cost you a lot of money. There's going to be a lot of discovery. Maybe at the end of the day, you did nothing wrong. And nobody did anything wrong. But it's going to cost $2 million of legal time and discovery. So what do you do? And this is, if there's one thing you can take away from this, it's on the M&A side, it's this your watch, our watch indemnity, which Cheryl will finish with.
In that example that Alec mentioned, you're not going to be able to be indemnified under a breach of rep or warranty because it's just not a breach. So one indemnity that you see quite frequently in these types of deals is a your watch, our watch indemnity, which essentially gives the buyer the benefit of an asset deal, even though it's a stock deal, because it apportions liability between the buyer and the seller, between the periods before closing and after closing. So the way it works is the seller would indemnify the buyer for liabilities relating to or arising out of the pre-closing ownership or operation of the business. Conversely, the buyer would also indemnify the seller for liabilities relating to or arising out of the post-closing ownership or operation of the target business. But this broad indemnity is what would, I think, protect you and what you would make a claim under in the Madoff type situation.
Mm-hmm. So on the your watch, our watch, it's an alien concept to a lot of people, who don't do this type of regulatory M&A, right? Because you said, I just sold you the stock of this entity. You're buying a business. You're supposed to take the risk of the business with you. This isn't an asset deal, nor could we do an asset deal for all the consents and all the other reasons we just talked about. So while it's become pretty standard in this area, not everybody knows about it. So if you're going to do it, it's important to think about that early at the letter of intent stage, where sometimes we're not yet involved, because to introduce that concept after that letter of intent is negotiated will end up being a big fight, because it's such a big change from non-financial services M&A. But it's one worth having, and I think it's one that's pretty standard and everybody should think about. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2014 7th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit Podcast Central at morganlewis.com. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefundsresources.